Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy. On today's edition of Focus on Africa, Congolese refugees in Rwanda are protesting in camps. We'll hear from one of them and find out why they are protesting. Also, we are keen to find out what caused the death of one adult and 8 children in Zanzibar after they ate tattoo meat. And want to become an Afrobeats dancer? We'll get all the secrets of the trade from the inspirational Easy Odigie.
If Afro is what you want to do, really, really what you want to do, learn every part of the business. Apart from just the choreography, learn the business side, try a network. And then if you are, try and collaborate a lot with people from different countries. Try and utilize social media, connect with dancers, connect with choreographers. It's a really beautiful, beautiful space. I would just say, no, it's not
but
easy,
first,
but when you do crack the code, it is worth
it. The country's home
Wednesday,
thousands
the 13th of Congolese
of
refugees.
In fact, some have not known any other home apart from Rwanda. These refugees fled the conflict in eastern DRC and have been hosted in refugee camps across neighboring Rwanda. They would like to return home, but hopes of ever returning home have been dashed because of the current security crisis in the region, where dozens of armed groups have been fighting Congolese forces and regional troops for nearly 30 years. Now, the Congolese refugees have been holding peaceful marches in Rwanda to protest killings in the DRC. They're appealing to the international community to intervene and stop what they describe as a genocide by regional troops who are fighting the M23 rebels in North Kivu province. The protests are also about living conditions in the refugee camps in Rwanda. We received this voice message from John, who was one of the protesters. He tells us why he chose to take to the streets to protest.
My name is Sengela John. I am from North Kivu in Masisi, in Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC. I've been here in Rwanda since 1997. It means I am here in Rwanda for 27 years. I fled with my siblings and my parents because of the genocide or massacres by the FDRL or the ex-FAL from Rwanda, who fled their country and came to our country, DRC, to continue the genocide that they began here in Rwanda. To be in a refugee camp, it's a traumatizing situation. So we are not happy because life is very difficult. The education is very limited. Job opportunities is somehow very, very limited compared to the other community here outside of the camp. So job opportunities is very limited to the refugees because the first criterion on the job market here in Rwanda is to be a Rwandan, to have a Rwandan citizenship. So that's a hindrance to our job opportunities because we are refugees. Last week we protested because we want to make a wake-up call to the international community because of the current situation in eastern part of the Congo, where our brethren who back there are being killed, are being eaten alive, are being buried alive, are being beheaded, are being killed every day. So we want the international community to please wake up. I don't know any other country that I have except Congo. There's no other country in this world which I can call my motherland except Congo. I'm not happy in Rwanda. We want to be back on our motherland. We want to pursue our dreams. We want to have a country. We want to have a place to call home. So for sure, we want to go back. We want to go back.
Well, to get us a fuller picture, I've been speaking to Samba Siusuzo from the BBC's Great Lakes team.
Well, it is a problem that has a long root and has been on for more than 2 decades now, but it is connected to the Rwandan genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi communities now in Rwanda. So when the government that supposedly committed genocide in Rwanda fled to Congo with an army, it is reported that groups or rebel groups that emigrated from that government prosecuted Congolese, now Tutsi communities, that they found in Congo, in the neighborhoods of Ruchuru, of Masisi, that is in eastern DR Congo, in the North Kivu province. So what happened is that in the late 90s, some of the members of those communities now fled to Rwanda, which was then kind of, I would say, friendly to them, because now the former rebels led by President Kagame, Tutsi rebels, were now controlling Rwanda. So they fled to Rwanda, which I would say became a home for them, but still they were refugees. But also there has been another influx of refugees with the recent rise of violence in Eastern DR Congo, who are also of Tutsi communities who fled again from Northern Kivu to Rwanda. So there are now just above 80,000 Congolese refugees on Rwanda territory.
Let's circle back to what has been happening in Rwanda, and there have been protests. Just last week, the protester in Kiziba camp. What were the protests all about, and what's been the outcome?
Actually, what we have seen, it is a series of political events in DR Congo. There was a political campaign that was calling for Rwandan government to stop helping the M23 refugees. So they were saying that even a genocide was being committed in DR Congo by supposedly the M23. But then afterwards, we saw also protests now in Congolese camps, now trying to put the pressure on the Congolese government, saying that we want to go home, we are persecuted once we go home, so you need to create favorable conditions for us to go back home. In the last 10 years, when we saw the protests in those Congolese refugees camps in Rwanda, there was violence. The Rwandan forces actually responded with violence and more than 10 refugees died. But now what we are seeing is totally different. The protests are now kind of supported by the government or allowed now by the government.
And when you're saying that they're being supported by the government, so you're referring to the Rwandan government, right?
Yes.
Who's responsible for them while they're living in camps in Rwanda?
The refugees in the camps in Rwanda, they are under the UNHCR shelter, but of course they are also on the supervision of the government of Rwanda, who are the host. And I think you remember that last year, President Kagame actually threatened that Rwanda is not going to receive no more refugees from Congo, saying that Rwanda cannot bear anymore the burden of the conflict in DR Congo or always receiving refugees from there.
And you know, there have been tensions between DRC and Rwanda, but I just wonder how the Congolese refugees are treated in Rwanda. Would you happen to know?
I wouldn't say they are good conditions. For now, they are given at around $2 per day to live by. But there's another key factor that people don't discuss much about. There is a scheme of Western countries, especially the United States of America, that has been taking families and individuals among the refugees and resettle them to the United States of America. This is one of the factors that has caused so many of the refugees actually not thinking much of going back home, because they have hope that one day they will be taken by the United States and resettled in America.
What sort of rights do they have? Can they access healthcare? Can they access education? Can they access jobs? What is it like for them?
It's so complex, to be honest. First of all, they are supposed to live in the camps. These people, they speak Kinyarwanda. When they're out of the camp, you won't really tell the difference between them and normal Rwandans. Those who have managed to step out of the camp, they live in the same conditions as Rwandans. So they have access to education, access to healthcare. And for many of them, they were born in Rwanda, so they have Rwandan ID. But for those who chose to stay in the camps, most of the time in the hopes to get the resettlements in the West, they have access to the education in the camps, the healthcare in the camps. They live the life of the camps.
And finally, Samba, because you say that the Rwandan government had expressed its frustration in saying that they can't take up this burden anymore, and so they wouldn't be allowing more refugees coming from the DRC. Is there a general feeling among Rwandans that possibly the refugees have overstayed their welcome?
I would say not really. The life of about 80,000 people in Rwanda wouldn't really burden a normal citizen out there. But in the politics, what does this mean? When this problem remains, it creates a regional problem. Because who are these young men fighting now in M23 rebels? They are the children of the refugees in Rwanda. They are saying, we are fighting for our rights. We are fighting for our mothers who are in camps in Rwanda to come back home.
Samba Sizuzo from the BBC's Great Lakes team. Eight children and one adult have died in Zanzibar, Tanzania, after eating sea turtle meat on Pemba Island. More than 70 other people were taken to hospital, according to local authorities. Sea turtle meat is considered a delicacy in this part of the world, but it periodically results in deaths from Chelonis toxicum, which is a type of food poisoning. Symptoms vary but include nausea, vomiting, and ulceration in the throat and mouth. In severe cases, patients can be affected by muscular weakness, partial paralysis and agitation, with some falling into a coma. The authorities in Zanzibar sent a disaster management team to the island over the weekend, urging people to avoid consuming the animals. I've been speaking to Doreen Walter-Mashi, a marine education and awareness officer based in Tanzania. I asked her to tell me what happened.
What happened is on the 7th of March, it was announced by the minister that 8 people died and 78 more people were hospitalized in Pemba, that they are the main island of Zanzibar Archipelago. And they thought it's because of eating turtle's meat. And they did some tests and it was confirmed that they ate turtle's meat a day or 2 days before. And after that, they started getting some symptoms. And right now we have 9 people died, 8 kids and 1 adult.
And Doreen, how has the news about the death of people consuming, you know, turtle meat been received? How have people reacted in Zanzibar, in Pemba, in the region?
So it's it's unfortunate news to hear. We hope now that with more education that they will stop eating the turtle, but it's not good news to hear that people died from eating some type of a meat that, although it's pronounced illegal here by the government, but it's still some very unfortunate news to hear.
There are reports that the people who died, they died as a result of consuming, you know, turtle meat, because there are certain elements within the turtle meat that is poisonous. Just explain that to me so then I can understand why this practice has been outlawed and why there are concerns, especially when it comes to health.
Actually, turtle meat is not poisonous. So the turtle meat originally is very okay, although you're not supposed to eat it because it's endangered, but the turtle meat is not poisonous. So there is a certain type of food in their diet that they eat, some type of algae or some type of sponge that is good for them. But the sponge or the algae is poisonous to us when we eat the meat. So when our turtle eats that type of sponge or type of algae, they don't die. It's good for them. It's good food, but it stays in their system for a few days, 2 weeks. So if you eat the turtle during the period when the toxic is still in their system, that's when you get sick or you die. As we see, the toxic is very violent to kids. So you have more kids dying than adults. And also the ban is not because they're poisonous. The ban was because it's an endangered species and it needs to be protected instead of being eaten.
And you've just talked about education. And if I can remember, sometime in November in 2021, we had about 7 people, including a 3-year-old, who died still in Pemba after consuming turtle meat, and 3 other people were hospitalized. Why do you think people still do this, despite even the fact that it has been banned? It's illegal.
It's because eating turtle's meat here is a delicacy. So I think there's some cultural attachment that they say that the meat tastes really good and it has some medicinal values attached to it. So they basically eat it because it's just a delicacy.
You know, people have done this for so many years. What's the history of people consuming turtle meat in Zanzibar, Unguja and Pemba?
So in Zanzibar, we have 2 main species. We have the oxbow species and the green turtle species. So actually eating turtle's meat here has not started yesterday or the day before. They've been eating the turtle for a bit some time. So after it was species declared endangered, that's when the ban started. So that it was illegal for anyone to fish out the organism or to capture it at the beach and eat it. But they still do it, but strictly. We had some few incidents where the organization is operating, where some fishermen caught some turtle and put them in their house. But we were doing the educational program, so they called us and we went and released the turtle back to the ocean.
In your education initiative, you know, just to create awareness, what do you tell the people there?
So our education program or efforts that we do here actually have 2 types. We have the one we do with kids at school. We have 4 schools that we do an educational program for them, where we tell them the importance of the turtle, that it helps to protect the marine ecosystem, that in turn, what they do also has an impact on our life. So they protect the corals, they help the coral to grow better. In turn, the coral has more fish for us to fish out. So we tell them how the turtles help them. And so as we should not eat them, instead we should protect them.
What would be advice, especially to people who are listening to this discussion, on why they should not eat turtle meat?
Personally, I would advise them not to eat the turtle, not because just it's endangered. It's because this fish does a lot for the marine ecosystem. It's a very important aspect of the ecosystem. Turtles have an aspect to play in the seagrass meadows. They have an aspect to play in the coral reef area. So it's those are very important ecosystem to coastal people. So this fish do help us to make sure we have enough fish, we have enough resources that we get from the ocean. So in turn, we should protect them instead of eating them. So when we eat them and maybe if the fish disappear completely, then we'll have a serious problem. Less fish at the seagrass or we'll have less fish in the corals, then that will impact our financial as coastal people since we depend on the marine resources to support our lives. So basically, I think we should protect these organisms at all costs because they do a lot for us. They make sure we have enough money, we have enough resources to support our economy, to support our lives.
And what are Zanzibar authorities really doing to enforce this?
As I said, the Zanzibar Authority has declared a ban on fishing out and eating these species. So right now, it's prohibited, and we have fisheries officers at every fishing spot that make sure that they check whatever is brought back to the ocean to make sure that no one is fishing out these organisms. And if you're found, there's a fine for you eating the meat.
All right. Thank you so much, Doreen Mushi, for speaking to us on Focus on Africa podcast. Thank you for giving us those insights, especially about turtle meat and, you know, the benefits that turtles really have on the ecosystem.
Thank you.
Afrobeat music has become Africa's most significant cultural export and has been spreading widely across the world. But I wonder if you've ever stopped and watch the visuals and the people dancing in the background. Have you done that? I often do because it's actually the dance choreography in Afrobeats that makes the entire production quite a mesmerizing watch. Did you know that dance is one of the biggest marketing tools of Afrobeat music, and female dancers represent almost more than 60% of Afrobeat music content? Izzy Odije is a Nigerian, US-based Afrofusion dancer and choreographer who performed with many artists like Ashaki, Rima, Burna Boy, Tiwa Savage, and many others. So, what's it like being an Afrobeat dancer, and how do you become one? Where do you start? Also, are dancers in the business paid fairly? Audrey Brown has been speaking with Izzy in our London studio. Let's meet her, shall we?
I've been dancing like my whole life, but professionally, it wasn't until I went to college. And we have like the African Students Association in my school.
And it has a drumming club. Yes. Has the dancing.
Yeah. So there was a day, I think I just attended one of the events and I did the choreography that the choreographer was teaching. And they asked me, oh, where are you from? And I'm like, yeah, I'm Nigerian. They're like, we're graduating next year. Do you want to start a dance team?
Wow. Just like that.
Just like that. And okay. I was just like, oh, okay. Sure.
What were you studying?
I was studying psychology.
So I can't imagine that your immigrant parents were like, oh, yeah, go dance.
They didn't know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they didn't know. Mm-hmm. So because as I was chasing my dance career, like I was obviously chasing my academic career at the same time. So my mom actually found out because like my videos were gaining traction on Facebook. So mm-hmm. She would go to work and her coworkers would be telling her like, yo, do you know your daughter danced here? As soon as I graduated, I went straight into dancing. I went for one interview as a caseworker, and I realized, like, if I am going to go into my psych field, I would need to invest and be there committed 100%, and I can't do both. Because if Davido hits me up and, like, says, music video next week, I'm going to leave that child.
Oh. Well, let's not say that child's loss is the world of dancers' gain. Let's just say that that child can look at you and say, I could be a dancer.
Exactly.
Would you say your start in the industry is a typical way of starting?
So before I went into African street styles, like I was within a hip hop dance company. Hip hop was my first love. I've been trained in ballet, jazz, modern.
Okay, what, since you were a child or subsequently?
Subsequently.
So you came to it as a sort of in your late teens?
Yes. So I started doing Afro when I was 18, like professionally. It's just now so finding, like, I'm combining what I love to do with who I am. So it's like bringing the culture into it. And then I just realized, like, okay, click in my head. This is where I'm supposed to be.
You're in an industry that many people don't really recognize actually as a valuable component.
Yeah.
We're talking very specifically about Afrobeats now.
Yes.
People see that you've said Davido, Burnaboy, mm-hmm. all of those big names. People don't necessarily check out the women, because they usually are women, right?
Yes.
That are bringing the sizzle to what you see on stage. Yes. Why is that?
I don't know what it is. Because even if you go down to the musicians, like majority of the names you would mention are male, mm-hmm. right? And you have the few queens out there that are really killing it. I couldn't pinpoint exactly why we're just overlooked. But I would say definitely behind the scenes, like actually working with a lot of camp, there are a lot of women that are running
in the industry.
In the industry, yes.
So hopefully that will change then. Is there a clear pipeline through which you can move to get from the little girl in the pink tutu?
Yes.
Or doing the street dance or doing hip hop or whatever to being on stage?
Yes. The pipeline is not as structured as most commercial styles. Like, so obviously if you're a hip hop dancer and you're assigned to an agency, you already have like a pipeline that, you know, has years of building and experience. However, if you're an Afro dancer, especially depending on your location, because like if you're on the continent, every show that happens on the continent is an African show. So like if you require dancers, you're going to hire African dancers. So in that space, it's just more so networking with choreographers who get these gigs, showcasing that you are good enough, utilizing social media, because right now, that's like one of the first go-to portfolios, quote unquote, that people would go to see your work.
And so you need to be known on that platform.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
At least just if you are networking with choreographers, just show your abilities. Because half of the dancers that I would hire for a gig is not because they have like 10,000 or 100,000 followers. It's that I can see that, hey, you're good enough to execute what it is I need you to execute. As a choreographer, however, same thing still applies. Utilizing social media, putting your work out there. But within the scene, because this is still like a very young industry that's building, sometimes a social media following can help, depending on, for example, if they want someone to choreograph for a show versus if they want someone to create a viral dance video for them to help their song blow in a certain degree.
Can you make money from it as a dancer?
That's what we're tackling now. Not a lot of people are making money. So like if you are someone who is popping on social media as a dancer, then you become like an influencer. So you go more so into the influencer marketing. Music is what you're marketing. So that's a way to make music. But if it's just as a profession baseline, it's very tough. I feel like there should be some type of intentionality from these camps to make sure that Afrobeats dancers are represented on that stage or hired to get those jobs. Some might say it's entitlement, but I believe that
entitlement
we have...
Entitlement on whose part? The
entitlement
dancers.
On the dancers' parts to be given those opportunities.
What?
Yeah, I've heard a lot. Some might say it's entitlement, but I do feel that Afrobeats dancers have a right. I'm 10 years in. There are dancers that I've started out with that were grinded when I first came on the scene, put in work, and today they've had to go get a 9-to-5 or pivot into another direction because there was no money, there was no way to build and upscale in their career because there are not a lot of opportunities. So now that things are starting to move and artists are starting to get bigger budgets, and yes, they're not like 100 artists, but at least there are a few more compared to 10 years ago that are getting budgets, I just feel like each team should just try and be intentional.
Do you think that dancers are seen almost just a couple of steps above sex workers? To be honest, I mean, like, especially dancers in those kinds of scenarios.
Yes.
Could that be the reason why people don't give them the respect for the skill and the work that they put in? It sounds like a harsh thing to say.
Yes.
But you know it's true.
Yes. I've gotten a lot of, like, comments here and there where someone might make a very foolish comment of saying, like, oh, let's say if they see a dance video, it'd be like, oh, this one, because she dances this way, way, then she must. You know what I'm saying? Or even when you enter a space and let's say you have like a short shredded skirt as your costume.
Yeah.
The way you're perceived before you perform is like, ah, look at these girls that just, you know what I'm saying? So I think like when we start to see it as an art and also to see it as a profitable business, that's when respect comes in. Because that's what the DJs do. Like, okay, I'm behind the artist. There's a certain kind of like disrespect that comes in with that. But once the DJs start to headline and make money, it becomes a different thing that, oh, they are a brand. So I think once dancers start to show numbers, even though we are, but show numbers that I guess the industry respects, then the perception would change. Because music didn't have this PR if you go down 15, 20 years ago. So
for somebody who wants to dance,
yes,
what would you tell her if she's listening to us now?
I would say if Afro is what you want to do, really, really what you want to do, learn every part of the business. Apart from just the choreography, learn the business side, try a network. And then if you are, try and collaborate a lot with people from different countries. Try and collaborate, try and utilize social media, connect with dancers, connect with choreographers. It's a really beautiful, beautiful space. So I would just say, have the heart. No, it's not easy, but when you do crack the code, it is worth it.
Audrey Brown there, speaking to Easy Odichie. And that's it for this episode of Focus on Africa podcast. It was put together by Yvette Twakira Maria, Alfonso Daniels, and Stefania Okereke. Kani Sharp supervised today's production, and Chris Ablakwa was the technical producer. Andrew Lombard was the editor. Don't forget to tune into our sister podcast, Africa Daily. It's a deep dive into one new story shaping the continent. I'm Richard Kagoe.
It all started with me asking my friends and family to write letters to my daughter, Coco, sharing their experiences and giving her advice for her life ahead. The idea blossomed into Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service, the podcast where, with the help of your letters, I'm creating a handbook to life full of advice for daughters everywhere. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.